Ja, aber ich will wende bak velem to swami shiva pao parki. Gantara shimad bhagavatam ki jai. Gaur pe manandi. So we'll begin this morning with reading from Srila Prabhupada Lilamrita, Volume 2, which is entitled Planting the Seed, and it describes Prabhupada's preaching activities in New York from 1965 to 1966. So it begins with a quote, I'm not sure from who, it's all in italics. It's the middle of a description from somebody. I don't remember who. Oh, from a person named Joan. Jamun. Did you hear Joan? Joan. I don't know. It's just she's describing Prabhupada's time, so I'm assuming she became a devotee. It's Jamuna?
Yeah.
Oh, Jamuna Devi. Oh, okay. Yeah. So she continues, so when we were all there sitting in the room with him, the Swami reached over the corner where there was a big pot of crystallized sugar syrup sticking on the outside. I thought, oh, this is supposed to be the piece de resistance. It's like in sword fighting, it's like the final blow, like, I'll get you. But I can't possibly take any more. But he reached his hand into the pot anyway and pulled up a huge, round, dripping gulab jamun. I said, oh no, I am so full, I can't take any. And he said, oh, take. And he made me hold out my hand and take it. Well, by the time I finished the gulab jamun, I was fully convinced that this would be the last time I would ever come there. Then he began explaining how the Vedic tradition, the women's side of the family, made lavish arrangements for the wedding. And since I was the only member of the family who had come to assist, I should come the next day and help him make the wedding feast. The next morning, at the time, while Janaki was decorating the room for the fire sacrifice, stringing leaves and flower garlands across the room, I went upstairs to meet Swamiji. When I arrived, he immediately sent me out shopping with a list, 5 or 6 items to purchase. One of these items was not available anywhere in the markets, although I spoke to many shopkeepers. When I came back, he asked me, have you attained all the items on the list? And I said, well, everything except for one. He said, what is that? And I told him, nobody knows what tomorrow is. He had me wash my hands and sat me in front of the temple room on the floor with a 5-pound bag of flour, 1 pound of butter, and a pitcher of water. And he looked down at me and said, can you make medium soft dough? I replied, do you mean a pastry or pie crust or a shortcut dough or a pate brie dough? What kind of pastry do you want? How old are you? He said. I said, I'm 25, Swamiji. He said, you're 25, and you can't make a medium soft dough? It is a custom in India that any young girl from any age from 5 years is experienced in making this dough. But never mind, I will show you. So he very deftly emptied the bag of flour and with his fingertips cut the butter until the mixture had become consistency of coarse meal. Then he made a well of in the center of a flour and poured in the right amount of water, and very deftly and expertly kneaded to a velvety smooth, medium soft dough. He then brought a tray of cooked potatoes, mashed them with his fingertips, and began to sprinkle in spices. He showed me how to make and form potato kachoris, which are fried Indian pastries with spiced potato filling. From 11 until 5 that afternoon, I sat in this one room making potato kachori. Meanwhile, in the course of the same afternoon, Swamiji brought in 15 other special vegetarian dishes, each one in a large enough quantity for 40 persons. He had made them single-handedly in a small, narrow kitchen. I was rather hot that afternoon, and I was perspiring. I asked, Swamiji, may I please have a glass of water? He peeked his head around the door and said, go wash your hands. And I immediately did so. And when Swamiji had a glass of water for me, he explained to me that while preparing this food for offering to the Supreme Lord, one should not think of eating, drinking, anything. So after drinking the glass of water, I went in and washed my hands and sat down. About 2 in the afternoon, I said, Swamiji, may I go have a cigarette? And he peeled his head around the corner and said, go wash your hands. So I did, and when I came back, he explained to me the 4 rules of Krishna consciousness. I continued to make the kacharis around 3:30, 4 o'clock. It was extremely warm in the room, and as Swamiji was bringing in one of his preparations, I was wiping my arm and hand across my forehead. He looked at me and said, please go and wash your hands. Again, I did so. And upon returning, he had moistened a paper towel for me. He explained that cooking for Krishna meant certain standards of cleanliness and purity that were different than the ones that I was accustomed to. So that begins... I remember Yamuna telling this story, too, one of her Prabhupada memory tapes. And, you know, and it really was her first experience with Krishna consciousness and her first experience with Srila Prabhupada. And a simple cooking lesson was actually really all about Krishna consciousness. You know, cooking for Krishna, cooking for the deities is actually a very intimate service. I remember when Nrsimha Kavacha, who is the GBC deity worship minister, he came to Boston. He actually had an interesting point I never really had thought of, and it took me a while to contemplate it. But he said that if you have a very qualified devotee who's Brahman initiated and one who is, you know, first initiated, and he said, but only one could do the puja and one could cook to prepare the prasadam, he said, better to have your second initiated devotee cook the prasadam and have your first initiated devotee do the puja. Mm. Now, ideally, both pujaris and people cooking should be up to the standard, everybody should be second initiated. But his point being was that pujari service is very important, and that's his role, to maintain the standards. But he said that actually maintaining and cooking and preparing prasadam for Krishna is even more intimate, more important service. And he really emphasized that same point in the pujari room as well as the kitchen, is the standard of cleanliness. So that was... You see Prabhupada also iterating the same point to Yamuna Devi. You know, not only Shishi Radhagopi Vallabhaki, Shishi Gauri Thai Ki, Jai Jagala Jai Valdeva Subhavi Ki. So these principles apply to all of Krishna consciousness, of course. So anyway... it's always nice to hear about Prabhupada's instructions, even something as simple.
It's nice that he said, go wash your hands. He didn't say, no, you can't have a cigarette.
What are
you
saying? Go wash your hands. But his answer to all these, you know, for all these instances was, even when she wanted to have a cigarette, he said, wash your hands.
Yes.
You know, because actually, one is... cleanliness brings about some, you know, brings about a steadiness of mind, equanimity. You know, the basic yoga principle.
I watch anything on TV now that it has the cooking shows.
Yeah.
And they're tasting everything. And
yeah.
And it's like, I don't want to eat that.
Yeah, cooks always do that. Yeah. Actually, that was an adjustment. When I started cooking for Didi's, that was an adjustment because that's how I grew up.
Right.
You know, you tasted everything.
Yeah, you tasted everything.
Yeah, so you had to learn how to prepare.
Especially if you taste it and then you use the same spoon in the pot. I've seen that over and over and over again. The French chef was
We're cooking kitchery, you had to pinch the rice, make sure you got soft enough, and you know. Yeah, it's an adjustment, but it's...
But it's amazing how all your other senses become acute enough that you can tell by looking at it, that it is the way it's supposed to be. You don't have to taste it.
And even just the idea that you're cooking for Krishna, you're not cooking for your own sense enjoyment. You know, like, I remember when I first time walked into a temple, kitchen in a temple in Chicago, I went, you know, and they're like, oh, no, Prabhu. You can't do that. It's not like that here. We're not cooking for our own enjoyment. We're cooking for Krishna's pleasure. So you want to make the preparations as tasteful and nice as possible, but it's not there for your enjoyment. You're not there to, you can't. When you're honoring prasadam, yes, there's some enjoyment that's there because that's healthy food should be enjoyable. But when you're preparing it, you're thinking that it really should be a meditation on how Krishna will be enjoying this. You know.
The tasting food, when even the chefs, whoever tastes the food while they're cooking, they're not tasting because of his sense gratification.
They're cooking because they want to make sure it tastes good.
Exactly. The same reason we.
Anyway, we'll maybe just, it's a little past 8:30, so maybe we'll end here, and we'll continue to read Srimad Bhagavatam. So I'll put the marker. Next page is. There you go. It's also really nice to hear these stories about how devotees... not only became devotees, but also how they brought their siblings. You know, Brahmananda, he and his brother were both devotees, you know. So, nice how, you know, a family member can sort of pull other family members in and inspire them also in Krishna consciousness. So, I mean, I'm not sure who Janaki was, Yamuna's sister, but I don't know if I ever met her or knew of her, but... How nice it is that she became a devotee and then her sister did so much service for Prabhupada. Yamuna, I've not read that 4 or 5 volume glorification of her service, but boy, she does so much for Srila Prabhupada. The preaching in England, the recording, you know, every morning we hear her singing, you know, and she... those nice books of Krishna consciousness, and such a nice preacher too. So we'll read Srimad Bhagavatam. Ganatra Srimad Bhagavatam ki. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Narayanam Namaskritam.
Narayanam Namaskritam.
Naram Chaiva Narottamam.
Naram Chaiva
Narottamam. Devam Saraswatim Vyasam.
Devam Saraswatim Vyasam.
Tato Jayam Udirayet. So we're continuing to read from the 5th canto, 9th chapter, which describes the supreme character of Jadabharata. And we're going to continue to read from text 12. And again, there's no words on the board, and it's a long verse, so I'll just read the verse, and we'll read the word for word together and the translation together. Ata kadachit kashchit ujvala patir badra kavyae purusha pashum alaba pachya kamaha Atta. Thereafter.
Thereafter.
Kadachit.
Kadachit.
At some time.
At some time.
Kashchit.
Kashchit.
Some.
Some.
Rishalapatihi.
Rishalapatihi.
Leader of the Shudras.
Leader of the Shudras.
Engaged in plundering.
Engaged in plundering.
The property of others.
The property of others.
Bhadrakalyai.
Bhadrakalyai.
Unto the goddess known as Bhadrakali. Purusha Pashun,
Purusha Pashun,
an animal in the shape of a man.
An animal in the shape of a man.
Alabata,
Alabata,
started to sacrifice.
Started to sacrifice.
Apachakamaha,
Apachakamaha,
desiring a son.
Desiring a son.
Translation and purport by His Divine Grace Srila Abhay Trinivinda Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada.
We did that verse yesterday, by the way.
Hmm?
We had this verse yesterday.
I read the verse yesterday?
Yeah.
Okay,
you
know, well. Well, sure. I mean, I was actually planning on reading a few verses together to try to get to the one with the purport. So, translation. At this time, desirous of obtaining a son, the leader of dacoits, who came from a Shudra family, wanted to worship the goddess Bhadrakali by offering her in sacrifice to a dull man, who is considered no better than an animal. And I'll read the next verse then. Dasha hi daiva muktasya pasho padavinna anucharat paridvarvanto nishi nishtista samaye tama sarvatayam anagitaha pashava akka mikena Vitina kedarin vira sanin amriga vara vida jabja samrak samanam angira prabhara suttam apashyan. Okay, so read the word for word for this verse 13. Tasya, of the leaders of the dacoits.
The leaders of the dacoits.
Ha, certainly.
Certainly.
Daiva muktasya,
Daiva muktasya,
by chance having escaped.
By chance having escaped.
Pasho,
Pasho,
of the human animal.
Of the human animal.
Padavin,
Padavin,
the path.
The path.
Tat anucharaha,
Tat anucharaha,
his followers or assistants.
His followers or assistants.
Paridvavantaha,
Paridvavantaha,
searching here and there to find. Nishi,
Nishi,
at night.
At night.
Nishita samaye,
Nishita samaye,
at midnight.
At midnight.
Tama avritayam,
being covered by darkness.
Anadigata pasavaha,
not catching the man animal.
Akasmikena
vidina,
by the unexpected law of providence. Kedaran,
the fields.
Vira asanena,
by a seat of a raised place.
Mriga varaha adibhyaha, from the deer, wild pigs, and so on.
As the deer, wild pigs, and so on.
Samakshamamanam,
Samakshamamanam,
protecting.
Protecting.
Angira pravara sutam,
Angira pravara sutam,
the son of the Brahmana descending from the Angira family.
The son of the Brahmana descending from the Angira family.
Apashan,
Apashan,
they found.
They found.
Translation by His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada. The leader of the dacoits captured a man animal for sacrifice, but he escaped, and the leader ordered his followers to find him. They ran in different directions but could not find him. Wandering here and there in the middle of the night, covered by dense darkness, they came to a paddy field where they saw the exalted son of the Angira family, Jadabharata, who was sitting in an elevated place, guarding the field against the attack of deer and wild pigs. So together, let's read. The leader of the dacoits captured a man animal for sacrifice. But he escaped. And the leader ordered his followers to find him. They ran in different directions, but could not find him. Wandering here and there, in the middle of the night, covered by dense darkness, they came to a paddy field, where they saw the exalted son of the Angira family, Jadabart, who was sitting in an elevated place, guarding the field against the attacks of deer and wild pigs. So we're continuing our story of Jadabart, who in two lifetimes ago was a great king who gave up his kingdom to seek self-realization and pure God consciousness. And he got very close, but he became attached to a deer. And in that deer life, he regretted his position, and now he was born into a very nice Brahmana family. And he was fully conscious, he was fully aware, he was not deficient, but his family were not necessarily devotees. They were Brahmana, and they were very well respected, but he was afraid to even associate with his immediate family, so he pretended to be dull-minded. And his brothers, as described in previous verses, only gave him, the most menial tasks to do. They're Brahmana families, but they gave him, go keep an eye on the dirt fields, and they gave him really just the basic remnants, the burnt remnants. You could cook rice, and there's that bit in the bottom you have to scrape off. That's the kind of food stuff that he was given, but he was so advanced that he never complained. He never held any grudges. He just simply accepted whatever came his way. He never protested. He had the ability to protest, but he didn't. And now some thugs have come along. And in India, these followers of Kali who make human sacrifices are known as thuggi, which is where we get the word thug from. A little bit of trivia. And normally it is animals that they worship to Kali, but these thugs would rob and sacrifice humans. But it is described in the previous verse that we read in the beginning, Purusha Pashu. So Purusha means human and Pashu means animal. So sometimes personalities, to be a human being is not just simply to have two legs and two arms and to walk upright. It means a level of consciousness and awareness. Sometimes we say cultures, people think that they have a lot of money and they listen to Mozart and so forth, that's culture. But how you're aware, how you treat other people, how you conduct yourself in your world, your quality and your character is what actually distinguishes a true human being between what is also known as a dvipada pashu, a two-legged animal. So these followers of Kali figured if they captured and sacrificed persons who were not really considered to be human, that wasn't really murder. And therefore Kali would accept their sacrifices. And in the story, they were chasing one after person who had gotten away from them. And they came to the paddy field where Jadabharata was sitting, and now We'll read what happens. We know what happens, but we'll continue to read. Does anybody have any comments or realizations they want to share before, or questions before I continue to read the next verse? No? Pobo?
I personally like to wait till the end if I say.
Oh, okay, sure. Okay. All right, so I'll wait till the end then. Yeah. So I'll just read the 14th verse then. Etta te enam anavijja lakshanam amashisha britta karma nishpatim manyamana bhatva asanaya chandrika grinam upanir muda vikashita vadana. The followers and servants of the dacoit chief considered Jayabharata to possess qualities quite suitable for a man-animal, and they decided that he was a perfect choice for sacrifice. Their faces bright with happiness, they bound him with ropes and brought him to the temple of the goddess Kali. And Srila Prabhupada's purport. In some parts of India, animalistic men are still sacrificed before the goddess Kali. However, such a sacrifice is only performed by Shudras and Dacoits. Their business is to plunder the wealthy, and to become successful, they offer an animalistic man before the goddess Kali. It should be noted that they never sacrifice an intelligent man before the goddess. In the body of the Brahmana, Bharata Maharaj appeared deaf and dumb. Yet he was the most intelligent man in the world. Nonetheless, being completely surrendered to the personality of Godhead, he remained in that condition and did not protest, being brought before the deity for slaughter. As we have learned from the previous verses, he was very strong and could have easily avoided being bound by ropes, but he did not do anything. He simply depended on the Supreme Personality of Godhead for his protection. Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur describes surrender unto the Supreme Lord in this way. Marabi rakabi ya icha tohara nitya dasa pati tuya adhikara. My Lord, I am now surrendered unto you. I am your eternal servant. And if you like, you can kill me. Or if you like, you can protect me. In any case, I am surrendered unto you. So, again, Jayabharata was not going to give up. In one sense, you could say he was pretending to be dull-minded. Although he was the most intelligent, yet he did not, as I say in the acting world, break character. simply for his own protection. He could have just simply said, hey, I'm not, you know, one of these persons you normally sacrifice. And they would have gone, oh, okay, well, we can't sacrifice you then. You're an intelligent man. Rather, he was so dependent on the Lord's protection that he had such faith, he had such nishta, fixed faith in the Supreme Lord, that he did not feel like, I have to protect myself in this situation. He just said, if you want to protect me, protect me. If it's now my time to die, it's now my time to die. He was completely surrendered to the will of the Lord. There's that very famous story of Draupadi in the assembly hall of the Kurus. Yudhishthir had lost the entire gambling match, lost his kingdom, lost his wealth, even gambled himself and his brothers away, and then he gambled his wife away. And then, of course, the Kurus, they took Draupadi, Duryodhana, took Draupadi and tried to disrobe her in front of the assembly hall simply to embarrass her husbands, because they couldn't do anything. And the whole time she's holding onto her cloth. Yeah. And Krishna is not coming to protect her at this point. Then she has one hand in the cloth and she's going, "Oh, Krishna, protect me." But still Krishna didn't come. Only when she raised up both hands to Krishna did Krishna come and they personally supply unlimited cloth. So they're pulling the cloth, more is coming, they're pulling more and more, and yet she's still fully robed. And the import of that lesson and the purport to this is that surrender has to be complete. Krishna observes and respects the desires of the living entities and of his devotees. So if we think, it's okay, I've got this, no need to protect me, Krishna says, okay, I respect that. But when we completely surrender, 100%, then Krishna's protection comes. And may manifest in different ways, and we'll read later on in the story how that will manifest. But regardless of whether the Lord comes directly or through the agency of his devotee, somehow or another, Krishna always will always protect us. Mother Dina, you have a question?
Who determined that a person was dull enough to be sacrificed?
Well, the dacoits. You know, it's their culture that when they sacrifice another human being, it's not somebody who's intelligent and clear. They want what they call a purusha pashu, somebody who's not all there, not a high-class intelligent person. That's so they observe Bharata, Jatabharata, and he appeared like a, you know, like a dull person. You know, he didn't respond. He, you know, wash this, then do this. They do that, then they wash. It was described even earlier in an earlier verse. His brothers gave him the task of farming to eat. You know, when you farm, you have to, or gardening, you have to even out the soil, right? Make it consistent. And he's just throwing dirt everywhere, and you know. So I think they just made that determination by observation. The chief had sent them to go find out this other person who had escaped, but they couldn't find him. They saw Bharata. They go, "Oh, okay, this is the person who's suitable for sacrifice." So anyway, it's almost 9 o'clock, so maybe we'll end here. Prabhu, you had something you wanted to speak on?
Yeah. I just have a question about this embedded culture. Like today, these are retarded people. We don't use the term, but
right, mentally retarded.
Today they're protected. Government takes care of them. But it seems in the embedded culture, nobody cared about these people. Even family. They would use them as a sacrifice instead of animals. That's not really nice.
No, I mean, they should be protected, and for all intents and purposes, I imagine they were, but there's bad people out there who will do bad things.
No, even family didn't protect Jatabharata. Their family didn't protect.
Oh, the family did,
they
no.
Were, yeah, so it seems that culture wasn't there, they should be protected. Nobody was here.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good question. It's obviously, you know, I mean, they didn't treat him very nice, period. You know, regardless of whether he was protected from dacoits or not, he wasn't treated well by his brothers.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, that's, unfortunately, human beings are human beings. You know, you find that there's failings and faults. You know, these are not pure devotees. In fact, they weren't even devotees, which is why Bharata didn't even want to have anything to do with them. You know, he was born into a nice Vaishnava family. He would have fully engaged with him. But simply because of they were brahmanas, they weren't devotees though. And therefore, you know, they weren't necessarily, you know, it's said that a Vaishnava is hard like a thunderbolt, but soft like a rose petal. In a sense that, you know, they're hard and that they're very strict in their own dealings and how they observe, you know, in their self-discipline. But they're also very compassionate towards others. They're sarva dukkha dukkhi. That the suffering of others becomes their suffering. They have great compassion. And normally a brahmana should be merciful. You know, that should be, they're non-violent and they're merciful. But for some reason or another, these brothers were not so kind to their younger brother, who was not so bright. And of course, we have a different view of mental retardation in our modern culture too. We understand, this physiological purpose, reason behind it. But oftentimes it can also be seen, and this is not the way we should see it, but oftentimes people will see a person born into a nice family, but they're deficient that way as a result of karma. Now, we may say, oh yes, we understand that's karma, we still have compassion. But others may think, well, it's their karma, their tough luck, And unfortunately, there are people who use the law of karma to be dismissive in that way. But our view should be, yes, it's their karma. Therefore, we should help them overcome this karma by giving them Krishna consciousness. So sometimes families come to this temple and they have children who are deficient in a similar way. And we should realize, these are spirit souls. They may be sometimes unmanageable. But somehow or another, by Krishna's arrangement, they've been brought to Krishna's temple, and therefore we should become ambassadors to Krishna's goodwill and show compassion, certainly more compassion than his family had for him. So, thank you, Prabhu. Anybody else? Yes, Prabhu.
As far as that goes, I would imagine that most families would be nice to a kid, even if they thought he was.
Yeah.
This seems to be like a pretty bad family. I think all that happened after the father died, too.
Mm.
And his father was trying to take care of him and do good.
Yeah, his father was very compassionate towards him, tried to teach him.
I'm saying that because in the purport, Prabhupada said it was a custom.
Yeah.
It was a custom to these people.
Yeah.
So it seems it was something like part of the culture.
I know.
It's not that it was like exception. Even today, I think he says even nowadays that something.
Yeah. When the British were ruling India, that was one of their campaigns, was to rid India of
these people were
Tuggy.
Just meant to do. That's why it's not like exception. There was one exception. It seems like more the rule.
One of the things that's difficult for us to understand. And there are many things that the things that Prabhupada says that we don't understand. And that's one of them. Just aside from that, the general point. I think we'd have to agree to just leave that point. Because I can't. But I just hold it for now. But the main thing is the concept of two-legged animals. Everybody in Kali Yuga is considered a two-legged animal, not us, because we're chanting Hare Krishna. I was brought up as as eating meat and everything. All of us were. So, that basically qualifies as we shouldn't emphasize that in preaching. It's a fact of life. You can't argue with it. According to Krishna conscious philosophy, it's a fact of life, but it's not a point, and it's not something we should be afraid to say in a class or anything. Prabhupada said it in many places. That's where we get it
Yeah, we should go out in the streets with Bhagavad Gitas and call everybody two-legged animals. We I don't think it would be effective. Wouldn't get a lot of grace points with it. That's not Vaisheshika's program.
I think we're a little illusioned in thinking that we're so advanced, because I can remember growing up, we always said deaf and dumb. People were called deaf and dumb.
Yeah.
So if you were deaf, you were dumb automatically.
Yeah.
And plus, like when I grew up, we used the N word.
Yeah.
And that's not that long ago.
Yeah.
So.
Well, dumb, the traditional use of the word dumb just means you can't speak.
Yeah.
You know, you're struck as though dumb.
Yeah.
You know. But, really what animal life just simply means eating, sleeping, mating, and defending. So you can do that. Prabhupada said, you can have a high-rise building, but how is that really different than a bird's nest? A bear can sleep for 6 months at a time, whatever, how many months during the hibernation season, and we may get 8 hours sleep. We may eat in fancy restaurants, a lion may hunt in the Serengeti, But essentially, what's the difference? Human life actually begins when we have the intelligence and we inquire, who am I? Why am I suffering? Why am I here in this particular position? And once we come to that point where we begin to make that basic inquiry about the self, that's actually the beginning of human life. Because we have intelligence. But if you apply that intelligence simply for eating, sleeping, mating, defending, that's just polished animal life, as Prabhupada would say. But if we actually use that God-given intelligence to actually inquire about who we are, what's the nature of the self? Who is God? And as soon as we begin to apply the intelligence in that way, that's actually the beginning of human life. And that's the difference between being a true human being and what we don't say publicly so much, but animal life, And Prabhupada would say this publicly too. He was on a news program. He said the human is distinguished from the animal, that we can inquire, who am I? He said, otherwise, it's just simply animal life. So, Prabhupada could say it publicly because Prabhupada is Prabhupada. Prabhupada had that purity and that integrity. But that's actually the distinction between animal life and human life. It isn't, somebody has a high culture, and somebody has what we call, tribal culture or whatever different, somebody could be living in a mud hut, simply wearing, a loincloth or tree branches. But if they actually have realization, if they actually have God consciousness, that's a true human being. But if you have somebody who lives in a high rise, Trump Tower, and eats fancy meals and whatever, but that's all they're doing, then that's animal life. So does that make it? Okay. Yes.
There's been a study done by people who work in the service industry for caring for mentally retarded and mentally challenged people. And they're saying that there is one characteristic that distinguishes the dull personality from more intelligent personalities. And the Prabhupada saying it's the idea that they are there only concerned with eating, sleeping, mating, and defending.
Yeah.
What this study showed is that the person who is, quote, dull has no empathy for beings around them.
Mm. Interesting.
It's very interesting.
Interesting, yeah.
The next time you encounter it, you can see that there
is
only self-absorption, but if you fall down, you continue to carry on.
And that's actually where, it's if you use the word now, it's a harsh term, but we used to use the word idiot. But idiot has the same root as idiosyncrasy or idiom. It's a term that's insular.
I like that.
So an idiot has no capacity to know what's going on around them and to respond appropriately. Now it's just an insult. It doesn't really have, like we use the word dumb or idiot.
Right.
because it's a mean term to use now. You can't use it, but they actually have a specific application in terms of a condition, you know. So, but you're right, that's actually a very interesting point, because even people who have, and you can be highly intelligent, like there are people who have Asperger's. And highly intelligent, I mean, MIT is crawling with people with Asperger's in Harvard, you know what I mean? Like, they can solve the most advanced quantum mechanic, you know, or mathematical problem, they can't tie their shoe. And and they have, and dealing with these folks can be rough at times because there's no empathy, there's no ability to gauge of what's happening, and they don't mean harm. It's not like they're mean, selfish people. It's just they don't have the capacity to gauge how they're affecting other people. You know, so it's not a maliciousness on their part. It's just a deficiency in that particular realm. So, anyway, it's 10 past. I do need to get to work, but anyway, it's really nice to have everybody's association again. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak a few words. And Gantra Shrimad Bhagavatam Ki, Srila Prabhupada Ki.